The winner by a score of 10-8, and the Olympic champion,
Kenny Tedder, is the champion of the Olympic Games.
The historic gold medal win by boxer Katie Taylor at London 2012. But what makes a sporting star? Is it nature or nurture, genetics or environment? I'm Dr. Lara Dungan, and in this episode of Science is Everywhere, I'm exploring the science of sport and attempting to find out what makes an athlete a winner. In a race to the finish line, what gives one runner an edge over another? And why, even when we have the talent and put in all the training, we still might not make the podium. So I'm out at UCD Sports Centre in Belfield now, watching some talented young athletes training here and asking someone who should know, scientist and athlete Brendan Egan. Brendan, what do you think about this? What makes a sports star? Is it nature or nurture?
I think there's a famous comment that people use in relation to genes, nature and nurture, which is that nature loads the gun and nurture pulls the trigger. And I think it's true also in the context of athletic performance, because athletic ability would be seen as a phenotype. So it's the interaction between your genes and your environment. And so in the case of an athlete, their environment tends to be the type of training that they've done over several years, the food that they eat on a daily basis, some of the, maybe perhaps the coaching that they receive from a psychological or a motor learning point of view. And so when these things all combine to interact, that's how you get the expression of your athletic ability. The influence of genotype on athletic performance is something that's received a lot of attention in recent years. And what's kind of interesting is that although there are a variety of studies that have shown that genes can influence factors such as muscle function or your motivation to exercise, there aren't too many studies that show that athletic ability, in terms of what separates an elite athlete from a medal winner from a non-medal winner, there's very little evidence to suggest that that is influenced by genetics.
Now, Brendan, you've been a sportsman for all of your life, playing intercounty Gaelic with Sligo, but what makes someone an elite athlete?
It varies from sport to sport, I think, because in terms of sports, you've got something like 100-metre sprint is just from, you know, you cover it in 10 seconds, you see a line in front of you, you run there as fast as you can. Something like a team sport then, like Gaelic football, is a very dynamic environment. Everything is changing, there's a variety of other skills, a combination of strength, power and endurance that come together to influence the ability of a games player compared to, for example, to an elite sprinter. So I don't think there's an easy way to explain how genetics can influence sports performance or whether an athlete is born or bred.
Now, Brendan, I know your field of expertise is nutrition and then the impact that diet has on performance, but just how big a factor can food be?
It's hugely important. So we can look at it from two different perspectives. One is the indirect effects on performance, and what I would say there is those that influence how you adapt to training. The direct effects would be those strategies that you employ in and around performance, be that a race or a match, that can directly influence performance. One of the things I often say to athletes is that, first of all, of course, you have to have natural talent, and maybe that's the genetics aspect that we're talking about here. The next thing, you have to have years of systematic training, and again, that's probably the 10,000 hours. But the third, or the next most important thing that influences your performance as an athlete, is going to be your diet. The example that I give to athletes is that your natural talent, your years of training, these are long-term things. In fact, you can't really change your natural talent. However, diet is something you can change after a one-hour talk or after reading a book, for example. So diet is something that's very easily changed and can have a huge influence when it comes to athletic performance.
So I'm out now at the sideline of a 10-kilometre run in the Phoenix Park and chatting with some of the bystanders. So what do you think? Is a sports star born or bred?
It's not necessarily in your genes how you're going to turn out. It depends on how you've lived your life.
I think they're born. I mean, you naturally have a sort of instinct, and it's all genetics as well come into it. I think training can help, but it'll only bring you so far.
It's a bit of both, I'd imagine. I'd say you have to have those fast muscles kind of thing anyway. So I suppose genetics plays a huge part.
You're influenced by your surroundings, you know, how you interact with people.
I think that there has to be a natural and innate ability, and I don't think it has to be worked on.
Definitely born.
You're born with your personality, but you need to be nurtured then to advance that.
Well, a certain amount of innate ability, but it all comes down to motivation and training, just like everything in life.
But what do winners themselves think? I'm with elite runner Maria McCambridge, first woman home in the Dublin City Marathon in 2013. I mean, Maria, is a winning athlete like you born or bred?
It's a tricky question of whether an athlete is born or bred, because I think there's definitely a combination of the two factors, because you do have to pick your parents, definitely. You need those good genes. But without the will to train, those genes will go to waste. So if you don't have that willingness to do the hard work, you're not going to go anywhere.
And what about you, Maria? Do you come from a sporting family? Kind of, is it in your genes?
I come from a very sporting family. To be honest, we're all involved in many different sports, from golf to cycling to tennis and running. A lot of my brothers and sisters do enjoy running. Running is not an easy sport. It really takes immense dedication and a willingness to work hard and to really push through a pain barrier, particularly in the marathon, where you're trying to overcome an extremely long distance as well. But I do really want to push myself. I absolutely love testing myself. I love to see how fast I can go, who I can beat on the line, and I do thrive on competition.
The question of whether an athlete is born or bred is a very interesting one. In broad terms, they're born. It does depend a bit on the sport, but if you look at the pure sports like sprinting, jumping, throwing, you know, the classic athletics events, and to a certain extent, field sports like GAA, rugby and so on, they're born. I mean, you need strength, speed, good cardiovascular endurance, good hand-eye coordination, and these things are largely inherited. I would say about, if you want a figure, 70% inherited, and the rest can be developed by training and specific exercises.
I'm back at UCD with Professor Colin Borum, the director of the Institute for Sport and Health, but who is himself a former Olympian. So Colin, if you're saying it's often as much as 70% genetic, what are the other elements?
Well, they're a combination, of course, of psychological elements and physical elements. The psychology of sport is very interesting. It's not totally well understood. But clearly you have to be competitive, you have to be able to focus, and you have to be pretty ruthless, both with yourself and others. Because to be a high-level sportsman takes a lot of time, a lot of dedication, a lot of sweat. On the physical side of it, you do have to be born with certain attributes. For example, if speed is very important in a lot of sports, and if you're not born with the right muscle type, the right muscle combination, you're just never going to be fast enough. However hard you try, you might improve your speed, but you'll never be at the very highest level. So these things are inherited, they're genetic. How far the sports psychology is genetic is a good question. We don't know, but I have a feeling it's more genetic than learnt.
So Colin, is training then what makes the difference between natural talent and a gold medal?
Well, training is incredibly important to an athlete, because even if 70 or 80% of an athlete's gifts are inherited, the other 20% are what make the difference between winning and losing. And in fact, at the very highest level, the difference between winning and losing can be infinitesimal. I mean, Olympic finals in swimming have been won by a hundredth of a second. And that means that the training element becomes terribly important. Who has trained the hardest? Who has trained the best? Who has got the extra edge over their components? Because when you see an Olympic final, let's say in the sprint or swimming or any Olympic final, you can be sure that all 8 or 10 or 15 of those athletes are genetically as close to perfect as you can get. The difference will be who has trained the best.
Here comes Usain Bolt. Usain Bolt storming through. He takes it again. Blake gets the silver. 9.64.
I mean, let's take the easy example of 100-metre sprint. All 8 individuals in the 100-metre sprint of an Olympic Games are capable of running under 10 seconds. That's right at the extreme of human performance. Now, who wins is going to be determined by the individual who has trained the best, has the best attitude, is feeling the best on the day. And that might make a difference of a hundredth, two hundredths of a second. So very, very small differences can make a huge difference in terms of medal placings.
They promised and they delivered.
Usain Bolt became the first Jamaican to win the Olympic title in 2008. And once again,
Usain Bolt, the fastest man in the world there in the 100 metres race. Now, Colin Boreham mentioned the often intangible but crucial aspect of psychology. So I've walked over to the UCD School of Psychology to meet Professor Aidan Moran. So Aidan, is sport as much mental as physical?
The question of whether sport is physical or mental is a very intriguing one, because for the average layperson on the street, it looks like action, that is physical performance, and thinking, that is psychology, are at opposite ends of the behavioural spectrum. But in fact, all you have to do is look at somebody who gets nervous in a competition and can't perform properly to realise that action and psychology are inextricably bound up. And in fact, right as far as the ancient Greeks, it was known that you had to do mental preparation as well as physical preparation.
So Aidan, does that mean that the brain is perhaps the most undervalued organ maybe in defining success?
When you talk to experts in any field, say music or surgery or sport, they'll say something like, oh, I always do mental practice. I thought everyone did it. But it turns out that not everyone does it. They do it a lot and people can be trained to do it. But now we know from science that mental practice uses similar pathways to those used by physical practice, and that the brain in a way can be fooled into improving its control of skill through imagination. And that's why you need imagination to be a very good athlete or a very good surgeon or indeed to be a very good scientist.
And Aidan, we've heard quite a bit about brain plasticity during this series. So when you study the brain activity of winning athletes, what do you find?
Broadly speaking, the same parts of the brain are activated by three different things. One, performing an action. Two, imagining performing an action. And thirdly, seeing other people perform the action. In other words, similar brain circuits are overlapping for different kinds of psychological activities. So where that leads us to is a remarkable conclusion in my view, which is that if you train people, athletes, to imagine performing a skill, if you ask them to repeatedly imagine performing a skill, by doing that, and that's called mental practice, what happens is their brain gets used to performing the skill in imagination, but it goes through broadly similar pathways as it would if it were actually doing the skill. And so we now have the extraordinary, you might even say science fiction type idea, that skills can be improved simply by imagining yourself doing them. Now, of course, it's not the same as saying you can get fit by sitting on your couch imagining yourself fit, but research, and I've done a lot of this work myself, so I know for a fact it's true, that if you alternate physical and mental practice of a task, it produces better learning and stronger memory than if you simply physically practice the task itself. And so the age-old idea, practice makes perfect, is true, but science now knows from psychology that mental practice plus physical practice is better than physical practice alone.
But Aidan, you still need that genetic base, don't you?
So if you can imagine a bucket, the size of the bucket is your genetic inheritance, but what goes into the bucket is the environment and the way in which you practice and so on. And so you can't really separate genetics and environment. What we could say is that genetic factors give you the talent that might get you noticed by somebody. But developing that talent and staying at the top through adversity requires something else altogether, which is training and practice.
Natalia Coyle is an athletic all-rounder. You have to be if your sport is Olympic modern pentathlon, which involves running, swimming, fencing, horse riding and shooting. Natalia, do you think you were born to be an athlete?
I don't think I was an athlete born and bred. I didn't actually start competing internationally until about 3.5 years ago now. I think I was born and bred as a person who loves sport, and I always enjoyed doing sport ever since I was younger. I was thrown in the deep end with everything I did, horse riding, running, everything. But I didn't start competing internationally until about 3 years ago. I think about when you're younger, it's all about doing what you love, and if you find something you really love, you're going to end up excelling at it anyway. there's a lot of athletes there who, when I grew up, they were 10 times better than me, but they're not where I am today because they didn't put in the hard work. And obviously you need a lot of skill with my event, with fencing and shooting. But I definitely think the hard work and the graft and the determination, a lot of people just fall by the wayside, but it's definitely the hard work and the determination that gets you there where you're at the top.
One's putting in a push. Natalia Coyle of Ireland putting in a really tough push here, and she could well take this one. And wow, that's...
And Natalia, I know you're doing a minimum of 25 hours training a week. So is winning everything for you?
I won a silver medal in a mixed relay in a World Cup, and it was Ireland's first international medal for modern pentathlon. Being able to stand on the podium with the medal around my neck, it's what I've always dreamed of, and I'm hoping that it's going to keep on continued success. Bigger and better things, you know, world champs and everything, and ultimately I hope to win a medal individually as well, you know, and keep getting bigger and better.
So Natalia's mental drive, her focus on winning and her punishing training schedule sets her apart. And it's that determination and singular self-belief which you find again and again in elite athletes. Former Irish tennis pro Conor Nyland made it to Wimbledon and played with the best in the world. To make it, he says you need the help of genetics, an early start, and of course, all that training as well.
If you take up tennis at, say, 11 or 12... I don't think you have any chance of making it to a Grand Slam. You know, you probably need to be playing the game from 5, 6, 7 years of age. And then not only that, you need really good guidance and coaching right from the very start.
And Connor, having played at that level, what do you think the top tennis players in the world have that makes them winners?
I think guys like Federer, Djokovic, Nadal, the guys in the top 3, 4 in the world or multiple Grand Slam winners, are kind of a perfect storm of naturally quick, strong, coordinated athletes of the highest caliber, but also having had great coaching right from the very start. So you look at Nadal, who had his uncle Tony Nadal, plus training with Carlos Moya, former number one in the world from age 12, and then having all these other natural gifts of being 6'2", 6'3", being able to run unbelievably quick, you know, just a great all-around athlete. The same with a Federer. You know, they would have been right at the top probably in any sport, but the fact that they had all this great guidance in the sport of tennis meant that they got right to the very top.
So the recipe for a sporting star seems to be a great natural physique combined with the opportunity of an early start, talented coaches, endless training, and that mental killer instinct to win. But can science help us identify gold medal winners at birth? Like racehorses. Imagine if we could know at birth which ones would win.
We've identified in the thoroughbred racehorse, there's a single gene that has a major contribution to how a horse is likely to perform on the racecourse. We've called this the speed gene. It's a gene called myostatin. And from reading the sequence of the letters of the DNA code in myostatin, we can predict how a horse is going to perform in terms of its distance capability, whether it's suited for short distance sprint races, middle distances or long distances.
That's Emmeline Hill, the UCD scientist credited with discovering the speed gene in racehorses.
Horses are very similar to human athletes in that some horses are suited to the 100 metre sprint type races and some horses are suited to more marathon distances or longer distances. And surprisingly, a single gene has a major influence on the distance aptitude that a horse has. Horses and thoroughbreds are a particular population and useful population to look at and to do studies looking at complex traits, particularly in terms of athleticism, because thoroughbreds come from a very small foundation population. Only a very small number of individuals have contributed to the entire gene pool. It's a closed gene pool. They're highly inbred, and therefore they're a great model to do these sorts of studies and to understand genes that are contributing to athletic potential or athletic ability.
So Emmeline, this ability to now find the speed gene in horses comes from their close-in breeding. But what about humans? Does it tell us anything about human genetics?
Well, many of the genes that we're finding are contributing to athletic ability in the horse are also genes that have been identified in other species, not just humans, in relation to metabolic and physiological traits. it's much more difficult to do this sort of work in humans because of the greater heterogeneity, the greater diversity within human populations. I mean, the purpose of the work that I do is to understand genes contributing to these traits in horses. And we may be able to learn something about exercise adaptation from that that may in the future be applicable in humans, not necessarily in understanding genes contributing to elite athleticism, but in the modification of particular traits, say for muscle weakness or strength. So I think the beauty of science is that you never know where it's going to lead.
And while Emmeline Hill has identified the speed gene, she still makes the point that making a horse a winner is 50% genes and 50% environment in terms of training, mental attitude, and in the horse's case, the rider. So you can't actually predict a winner at birth. So in this question of nature versus nurture, Trinity College psychologist Fiona Newell brings it all back to the brain.
So the question I think we're more interested in nowadays is not which one wins, genes or environment, but what are the essential forces that are required to realise behaviour X or behaviour Y, if you like, and how do those things merge together? I think it's not enough just to look at genes. Genes are fascinating. We have to look at them. But what's more interesting is this ecosystem, the whole system, if you like, the systems neuroscience, looking at all the influential factors from basic genetic components, DNA components, right up to, you know, whether the environmental effects that we have throughout our development lifespan. Sensory systems are one of the sort of research areas in which these separate research areas are coming together to try and get a better picture of how our senses, for example, develop. And I think this is an exciting area of research.
So it's nature and nurture, with perhaps quite a bit of luck, which makes a star. I'm Dr. Laura Dungan, and this is Science is Everywhere. Next week, I'm talking technology, and with an amazing athlete who is rapidly becoming, as he says himself, a bionic man.
To stand and walk as someone who spends most of their time either lying down or sitting in a wheelchair, to have the option and access to a machine that allows me to stand and walk is hugely impactful from a psychological and a physical point of view.